It's time now for the Peace Health Peace Harbor Hospital COVID-19 checkup, featuring members of the Peace Harbor Hospital doctor and nurse staff and administration. Joining me today is Dr. Bob Pelz. He's the infectious disease specialist and Peace Health Medical Director of Infection Prevention. And Dr. Pelz, welcome. How are you doing today?
I'm great, George. Thank you.
The landscape and the story on COVID-19 is ever changing. I mean, it's almost a daily or a weekly basis that we're hearing new things that are popping up, new things that are going on. Vaccines on the horizon is one of the things that we're hearing a lot about in the news: AstraZeneca, Novavax, Johnson & Johnson. Can you give us an overview of which ones appear close to getting emergency use authorization in the U.S.?
Yeah, sure. So there are, as you said, those three vaccines, AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson, and Novavax. AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson are probably the closest to receiving FDA approval, and it's anybody's guess, I think, as to when those are going to come to the market. Fauci is saying weeks, not months. I don't really know how to interpret that. Novavax has data from a trial out of the UK, but they fairly recently started a trial in the US and Mexico, and it's possible the FDA will require that trial to be done, but they're accruing patients pretty quickly. They've got about half of their patients already accrued for their target size of about 30,000 people to participate in that trial.
Now, AstraZeneca is already approved in the UK. They've been using that for about a month or so now. What's the delay? Is it because they need U.S. statistics in order to approve it?
Yeah, there are a handful of issues with the AstraZeneca vaccine. It's been approved in the UK, Mexico, India, Pakistan, probably some other countries since the last time I looked at this, since a day in COVID time is more like a year. There were some safety concerns during the vaccine trial, with a couple of people having something called transverse myelitis, which is a neurologic injury, but they had the data studied by an independent body of experts, not affiliated with the company, and they decided that those were not related to the vaccine. It's possible that that's part of the reluctance. The newer vaccines don't seem to be as effective as the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines that we're currently giving in Lane County. The newer vaccines are more on the order of, say, 70% overall effectiveness in preventing COVID.
I heard that Johnson & Johnson may be as good as 80%, but one of the benefits of, I believe it's the Johnson & Johnson one, is that it's a single dose and doesn't require the freezing temperatures that the Pfizer and Moderna, is that correct?
Yeah, that's true, George, and that's true that regarding the single dose, that's the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, as you said. So it's a lot more convenient for patients, easier for healthcare delivery to not have to worry about bringing people back for a second dose, and it's half the price or something like that if you're only giving one dose instead of two. The Pfizer vaccine is like $19 a dose times two, and Moderna is anywhere between $32 and $37 a dose. Johnson & Johnson is probably going to end up in the range of about $10 a dose, and you only have to give it once. And as you said, all three of these newer vaccines don't have to be stored at the super cold temperatures required for mRNA vaccines, because mRNA is a very fragile kind of molecule. But the cost and the convenience and the storage requirements are all significant advantages for these three new vaccines, even though they may not be quite as effective in completely preventing COVID infection.
Well, and when you think of 70 to 80%, isn't that also on average better than the annual flu vaccines that we get, or is it competent with that?
No, I think that's an excellent point, George. The annual flu vaccine is not a great vaccine. It's maybe 50% effective in a typical year. While these vaccines, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine was found to be 72% effective overall in the U.S., but overall it's 85% effective in preventing more severe disease, and they didn't have anybody requiring hospitalization in that trial of over 43,000 patients. So while people might get COVID more frequently with this vaccine than with the Moderna or Pfizer vaccine, it does seem to still be pretty effective in preventing people from getting the severe infections that's filling up our hospitals and has caused, over 400,000 deaths in the United States, which is more than one per thousand people has died of COVID in about a year in the United States. So, you know, the J&J vaccine may not be quite as effective in preventing COVID, but it does seem to be very effective in preventing the more serious illnesses.
And of course, that's a very good thing. I mean, even if someone's going to get it, if they could keep from going to the hospital, that's, you know, that's a win-win as far as, you know, most people are concerned.
And there weren't even any hospitalizations among recipients of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine at starting 28 days after they got the dose.
Now, you mentioned some of the deaths that we've seen over time because of COVID-19. Now that more people seem to be getting the vaccines, are we seeing adverse reactions about that? I saw something I read this morning that I think 36 people have died, but I didn't know if that was U.S. or worldwide or whatever. And they weren't 100% sure that it was in as a result of the vaccine, but they had been people that had been vaccinated. What are we seeing as far as adverse reactions?
Well, there's a few things to think about in terms of this vaccine. If it's 95% protective, that doesn't mean it's 100% protective. People can still get COVID after having received the Moderna or Pfizer vaccine, particularly in the weeks or days immediately after the first and second doses when the immune system hasn't fully responded. There are a couple of different kinds of reactions that you worry about with vaccines. The first one is the immediate reaction, the allergic reaction that people will have within, 30 to 60 minutes of receiving the vaccine. Anaphylaxis is the worst of these manifestations, and it's where you have a, you know, dangerous drop in the blood pressure. People need epinephrine, have to go to the emergency room. Both the Moderna and Pfizer vaccine are more likely to cause either allergic reactions or just sort of the unpleasant reactions that people are describing with fevers and achy muscles and sore arms. In general, it's kind of a no-brainer to me that the risk of the disease is much, much higher than the risk of the vaccine. As far as your statistic on the number of deaths, I don't know what those deaths are blamed on, if these are frail patients that can't tolerate having a fever, or if they died of something else unrelated to the vaccine thereafter. I think we're still waiting for more information about that.
Is the reactions that we've gotten pretty much what was expected? I mean, they were certain there was going to be a few people who might have complications due to this. A lot of it, I imagine, is probably site issues, like where the shot was injected, as opposed to full body stuff.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's very common to get a sore arm with this. And anybody who's ever had the Shingrix vaccine, that's a shingles vaccine that's been on the market for a few years, has probably experienced this kind of thing where you can get a sore arm or achy muscles or a low-grade fever for a day or so after getting the vaccine. These clinical trials were done with, between Moderna and Pfizer, that's over 70,000 people. But when you start giving it to millions of people, you're likely to see uncommon reactions that you won't even pick up with clinical trials the size of the ones that have been done already.
Now, we're also hearing, we talked about the idea that there are these other strains out there. There are these strains that seem to be more contagious. And then today, ABC News came out with a story that said there is also another strain that could reinfect people that have already had COVID-19. What are our concerns about these?
Yeah, this I find to be the most concerning thing on the horizon with COVID right now. There are three main strains that you hear talked about. One is the UK variant, one is the South Africa variant, and there's a Brazil variant. The magazine The Atlantic had an article yesterday that described in the city of Manaus in the kind of Amazon region of Brazil, where something like 70% of the people had already been infected with COVID, they're seeing a second epidemic of COVID because this new strain is able to infect people that had already been infected with a regular COVID. And the vaccines don't seem to work as well as on the variant strain, particularly in South Africa. The Novavax was 96% protective against the old strain of coronavirus, but only about 57% protective against the South Africa strain. And these strains are very contagious, and they very quickly replace the COVID strains that were present previously. So in South Africa right now, something like 95% of the cases of COVID are caused by this new strain, which has completely replaced the old strain just because it's more contagious and is capable of infecting people that had been infected with the previous virus.
Do we know anything about how these strains morph or how they change, you know, over time? Is it some other things that mix in with it? What causes generally a strain to morph into something more dangerous?
Well, it's a random process where there are changes in the genetic material of the virus. And that's what happens with influenza. From year to year, you get these minor changes in the virus that allow the virus to evade our immune response and require us to make a new flu vaccine every year. So just by random chance, the virus will have a mutation that makes it more resistant to infection. So it's more likely to infect people, which means it's more likely to get passed to the next person. And these new strains are selected for. And that's, you know, basically how evolution works. With the South Africa and UK strains, they've accumulated 8 different mutations in the spike protein, which is the protein that the vaccines are designed to fight against. And it seems like these changes in that spike protein have made it harder for our immune systems to recognize and fight off the virus.
Have we seen any of these strains here within the state?
Yeah, there was a Brazil strain isolated in Minnesota. There have been two of the South Africa strains isolated in South Carolina and one in Maryland. And those South Africa strains were in people that had not traveled to South Africa. So they must have gotten it from somebody who got it from somebody who got it from South Africa. So there's probably already some spread of both of those strains of virus in the United States. In Oregon, we've seen, at last count that I heard about, was 3 different people infected with the UK variant. And there are new variants popping up. There's a new California variant that might be more contagious. CDC tracks this. Most of the states in the country have seen one or more of these various strains.
Now, I think you've already answered this next question because of the spike protein comment, but have Pfizer, Moderna vaccines, you know, have they suffered more so under these new strains that are out?
Yeah, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine was effective against 57% in South Africa, 72% in the United States. Novavax was 50% effective in the South Africa strain, 96% effective with the original virus. So these vaccines were designed at a time when we knew what the COVID spike protein looked like, but now we're dealing with a new COVID spike protein. So the old vaccine causes an immune response. People make very effective antibodies to the old coronavirus, but those antibodies don't stick to the newer variants as well as they did to the older virus.
Now, because we know the process of identifying these spike proteins, does that make a secondary vaccine easier to come up with, or is that just speculative at this point?
No, I think you're exactly right. To be able to stay on top of this virus, we're going to have to do a good job of surveillance for these different mutations so that we recognize when something has changed. You know, by the time we really knew what was going on in South Africa, the strain that's predominant down there had already spread to be, you know, the most common virus down there. So we need to be faster about identifying these strains, and we need to be faster about modifying the vaccine so that they're effective against the new variant strains.
One of the things that's talked about now, and I think maybe even Peace Harbor has implemented, I'm not 100% sure on that, but is the double masking. Does that help any, or is that just overkill at this point?
Yeah, there's not a lot of data written out there about double masking with, you know, the masks that you buy over the counter, or cloth masks or bandanas or that side of the kind of thing, the neck gaiters. Early on in the epidemic, there was an article that suggested that the neck gaiter masks are very close to useless. They don't really stop people from spreading COVID if they're infected. There are two main reasons to wear a mask. One is to protect yourself from somebody else, and the other is if you're infected, wearing a mask protects them from you. The single layer masks probably don't work all that well. Whether double layers of a cloth mask are better, Fauci said it's a common sense kind of thing, but there's not really a lot of data to support its use. It's unlikely to be harmful if you want a double mask, but the CDC is not recommending it yet. I don't think we have enough data to really stake a position on that.
So there's not a good or bad time to be double masking. It's just a matter of personal preference at this point.
Yeah, the medical masks are probably better than the over-the-counter masks or neck gaiters or bandanas. N95 masks are probably a little bit better than than the regular surgical masks. But wearing a mask is better than not wearing a mask. And that seems to be the key thing, is that you just do something at least. I don't want to get too picky about what kind of masks people use.
Now, last time we spoke, when Dr. MacArthur was with us, she said February 8th is about the time when they'll probably start vaccinating people over 80. Are they still working on how to do that effectively, and how to bring these people in to make that happen? Is that something still in process?
Yeah, the February 8th target, is, as far as I know, is still what the state is hoping to achieve. As we discussed before we went on air, it's over 80-year-olds have a hard time signing up online to do stuff often. I mean, I'm 57, and I always need to get help from my kids when I need to do something on the internet, and it's probably only going to get worse. So trying to reach out to that community isn't necessarily easy. Getting them transported into safely to a place where they can get a vaccine is going to be challenging. A lot of these folks are getting vaccinated in long-term care facilities, but exclusive of the people in long-term care, there's probably 160 to 180,000 people in Oregon that are over 80 years old, and trying to get them all vaccinated is going to be a big logistical challenge. And you don't want to leave behind the people that are medically frail or in more marginalized communities.
Last question along the same lines. Are we seeing a decent, consistent supply of vaccines coming? I know I've been watching the OHA website, and they are slowly getting more in, more than what we're using. But are we seeing an influx of supply, or is the supply chain still kind of wonky?
There are three things that limit how fast you can give the vaccine out. One is how much vaccine you've got. The other is whether you've got enough people to put shots in arms. And then the third is whether people are willing to receive the vaccine. And those are the three kind of bottlenecks that you can encounter. Right now, across the country, for the most part, and certainly in Oregon, it seems that the real bottleneck here is vaccine supply. The OHA director, in a call I was on last week, said that he hasn't encountered anybody giving vaccines that couldn't give more if they had it to give. Peace Health is holding vaccine clinics as fast as we can. We're getting rid of every dose that we're given, and we haven't wasted any doses yet. If we had more vaccine to give, we would be able to give more. But it's really right now the thing that's limiting us is the supply of vaccine.
Dr. Bob,
when these new vaccines come on market, that'll make a big difference.
Okay, absolutely. Dr. Bob Pels is the infectious disease specialist and Peace Health Medical Director of Infection Prevention. Dr. Pels, thank you so much for this very valuable information. We appreciate it.
Thank you, George.
That's our COVID-19 checkup for this Tuesday morning. You've been listening to the Peace Health Peace Harbor Hospital COVID-19 checkup. Join us on the first and third Tuesday of each month as we update you on the latest COVID-19 information available. Sponsored by Peace Health Peace Harbor Medical Center.